All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Awakening Together's monthly Sat Song. This month's guest is James Swartz. James comes from an impeccable lineage. He is endowed with 40 plus years of teaching experience. He unveils timeless knowledge with clarity, candor, and humor. He has become one of Vedanta's most powerful voices for East and West alike. His website, shiningworld.com, is a major resource of non-dual wisdom. And his best-selling book, How to Attain Enlightenment, has taken the spiritual world by storm. Welcome, James.
Hi.
It's funny to hear somebody talk about you in the third person like that, isn't it?
No, I talk about myself in the third person all the time.
Very good. James, what we normally do is ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey, and we'll just use that as a jumping off point. I also want to mention, by the way, though, I failed to mention, our own Ann Blanchard is here joining us for this interview, and Ann will join us as she feels led to do so.
All right, good.
Good. Yeah.
So you want to hear about me?
I do want to hear about you.
Well, I don't intend to talk about myself because I've had such an interesting life, but I've written a book called Mystic by Default, where I talk about my spiritual journey, which I can, the 2 years that I was with my teacher in India. I went to India during the 60s, and I was formerly a businessman. I had a little money in my pocket, and I had a big epiphany in Hawaii, which turned my life around, where I had a vision of the self, or God, if you want to call it God. I don't know what your terminology is for the higher power or God or whatever.
Awareness, self, consciousness.
Yeah, awareness, yes. Consciousness, existence, self, whatever. Yeah, okay, we're on the same page then on the terminology. And it turned my life around. I was a businessman, a very successful businessman in Hawaii. And this epiphany I had turned my life around, and I ended up in India, where I came in contact with the science of self-knowledge, which is called Vedanta. And I met my guru. He was the most famous yogi in India at that time. In fact, they called him the Pope of India. He took a liking to me, and I spent 2 years with him traveling around the world listening to the teachings of Vedanta, which set me free when I was about 31 years old. Subsequently, I've been teaching Vedanta around the world for almost 50 years now. And I have a big website. It's probably the most comprehensive non-dual website on the web. And people from all over the world listen to these teachings simply because you probably hadn't heard of Vedanta before, or maybe you had, but the reason is because Vedanta is basically has an Indian background, and there's a lot of Sanskrit and so forth and so on. And it wasn't until I came along and wrote these books, particularly the first one called How to Attain Enlightenment, that somebody has put these teachings of the Vedas into really clear, simple, straightforward English. Swamis had been coming to India for a long time, but because of the cultural overlay, you know, the mala beads and the orange clothes and the strange accents and the glowy skin and the long black hair and et cetera, you know, that was never really received very well by the Western, by Western people. I'm an American, and I had the advantage of actually hearing these teachings from a great sage in India. And I have the gift of gab, and I'm a pretty good writer. So I was able to, like, put these texts and these teachings in a format that's really made it acceptable. to Western people. And what made me popular was the second chapter of that book, which is attacks the basic enlightenment myths that are operating in the spiritual world in the West that have basically stymied and frustrated people for the last 20 or 30 years. And when people read that second chapter of the book, I started to receive, the book became a bestseller, and I started to receive invitations to speak around the world on this topic, because it relieved a lot of people's anxiety who were, you know, sincere people who had been working for years trying to get freedom, now understood why the modern teachings weren't working. And so that's why basically we're talking together now. And these teachings have gone viral. They're all over the world now. They're all over the, you know, web and so forth and so on. So, and having a huge impact on the modern spiritual world.
Well, and James, what I understand from looking at, you know, from listening to your other videos that you've done, and from reading some of your material, is the main distinction that you're drawing that I think you alluded to a moment ago between the pure Vedanta teachings and what's passed for non-dual teachings in the Western world is it's the difference between experience and knowledge.
Yes, that's correct. That's absolutely, you got it in one. because the idea of Vedanta is that the reality is non-dual consciousness, or it's all, we could say in terms of your language, everything is God.
Right.
So if everything is God or consciousness or existence, then whatever we're experiencing right now is God.
Sure.
Right? So any attempt to experience God is based upon a lack of understanding about the nature of God, that God is all pervasive, that God exists, is always present, and that God is my innermost essence, my innermost spiritual essence. And most of these modern teachings have what we call the yogic view, or the experiential view of enlightenment, which is that God is, or the self, or the truth, or whatever it is, or the higher state, or whatever it is someplace else, in a higher state, in a different dimension, in heaven, somewhere else.
Something you have to achieve.
Something you have to achieve or attain. That's correct.
Yeah.
And therefore, we say, well, that's not actually possible, because you're already experiencing it. So you're frustrating yourself by trying to experience what you're already experiencing, which means that you don't have an experience problem. You have an ignorance problem. You don't know what God is. If you knew what God was, you wouldn't try to experience it, because you'd realize you're experiencing it 24/7. Which means that, and for this knowledge to happen, you need a means of knowledge. You can indirectly say, like they do in the Advaita world, the neo-Advaita world, or the modern non-dual world, they say, well, you need to experience it in yourself, but that doesn't work because you're already experiencing it, obviously. So for any kind of bit of knowledge to work, you need a means of knowledge. And a means of knowledge means what? Like, for instance, my eyes. For you to see me on this video, you need eyes. For you to hear me, you need ears. For you to, you know, to know what I'm feeling, you need a heart. For you to understand what I'm saying, you need an intellect or a mind. Unfortunately, the instruments that we have as human beings, which is a body, a mind, and intellect, don't work on God. In other words, God's not an object of perception, because our instruments are limited and God's unlimited. So there's no way that we can directly perceive God. But we can know God, and how would we know God? Not as an object somewhere else, but by removing our ignorance about the nature of God.
And the nature of ourselves at the same time, yeah, well, because that's well, what God, we are, right?
God's non-different from the self. That's right. What non-duality means.
Right, exactly.
The word God and the self are synonymous. Although in Western terminology, the word God actually refers to a creator, sustainer, and destroyer of the universe. Whereas if reality is a non-dual consciousness, then there is no creation. That's another idea.
Right.
So the problem then is, you know, I need I need a means of knowledge that's a complete means of knowledge, because this ignorance of who I am all is what is hardwired. That is, from very beginning, the moment I'm born, I think that, you know, my senses and mind are legitimate means of knowledge. Well, they are legitimate means of knowledge for objects, but they're not legitimate means of knowledge for myself.
Right.
This is why in religion, you know, you have people believing in God, which is indirect knowledge, but they don't have direct knowledge of God. So how are you going to get direct knowledge of God? Well, you're going to have to expose your mind to an impersonal, valid, scientific means of knowledge, which is what Vedanta is. Vedanta is called Brahma Vidya. Brahma Vidya means the science of consciousness, or the science of existence, or the science of the absolute, you could say. And all it does is, if you are qualified for it and you expose your mind to these teachings in a systematic way, with commitment, and you have a teacher, then you can understand the nature of God and remove your sense of limitation. Because our view is that everything everybody's doing right here on Earth is an attempt to remove a sense of limitation. Every single action we do is an attempt to get rid of some sense of limitation, which means what? That what we really want is freedom from limitation. We don't really want the objects that we think we want.
Right.
I don't want a relationship because I want you. I want a relationship. I want a relationship because it frees me from the sense of loneliness and incompleteness that I'm feeling. You know, I don't want money because for money's sake. I want money because it removes my sense of insecurity, etc., etc., etc. I don't want power because for its own sake. I want power because it relieves my feeling of smallness and incompleteness and inadequacy. So, you know, everybody, our view is that everybody's looking for freedom, and freedom equals God, equals love, equals yourself.
Right. Yeah, which is an experience of the unlimited, as you said, is what really motivates all of our desires, even if we don't recognize that.
Well, it's experience of my own limitlessness.
Right.
Not if you say the unlimited, then you imply that it's something other than you.
Right.
So Vedanta says that I, that person that you're experiencing 24/7, is actually free, because it's non-separate from God, quote unquote.
Right. Of course, that doesn't do much good if you believe that you're a limited individual and God is other than you. And right.
Well, it. But if you believe that you're a limited individual and God's somebody other than you, and you start to grow up a little bit, you'll see that that belief doesn't actually work very well. In which case, you'll question this belief about your limitation, and then you'll be led to a non-dual teaching.
Right.
So, because that belief in separation or duality just doesn't work. It doesn't make you happy. There's always conflict involved in it. Sounds like I'm preaching to the choir here.
Maybe I'm just real agreeable. No, I'm teasing. Yeah, I think you are. I mean, I think that...
I can see you understand it pretty well. You've got a pretty good understanding of it.
Well, and we're fortunate to have a very good teacher. Our founder is Regina Dawn Akers, and she is... She's actually leading a number of us through a program called Consistent Gentle Healing, where we are, in fact, learning to let go of the belief that we're individuals, that, that we're limited in any way. And just, you know, those thoughts that say, hey, I'm a separate individual, separate from everybody else in my experience, separate from everything. So so it is a process that we're being led through in conjunction with Regina as an external teacher. Of course, what she keeps pointing us to is the inner teacher. And so actually that leads me to a question about,
that's a good question, because, you know, the problem with inner teachers is that, you know, it's how you interpret the words of the inner teacher, and inner teachers don't tend to always tell you exactly what you need to know. They often tell you what you think you want to hear. That's why our tradition is based upon scripture. Mm-hmm. Because the scriptures of Vedanta are the words of the inner teacher.
Right.
And that it's a time-tested means of knowledge. In other words, Vedanta is maybe 10, 15, 20,000 years old. So it's a vetted, proven means of knowledge that's impersonal. In other words, it doesn't allow the person who's ignorant to, like, interpret the words of the inner teacher. Because you have a lot of people in the spiritual world who are channeling, or who have dead gurus or ascended masters and all this sort of thing, which are, you know, supposedly somewhere else telling them what, you know. But when you start questioning those people, you discover that, you know, their interpretation of this transmission that they're getting from within or from beyond or something like that, it's definitely open to question. There's all kinds of logical inconsistencies and so forth and so on.
Right. Well, and unlike some traditions, because we are all God or consciousness or awareness, what we realize is we all have access to access sounds weird, because again that sounds dualistic, but we can all access this inner wisdom, this truth, and so I'm not entirely reliant or maybe at all reliant on someone else to say, you know, Jesus told me to tell you, right? It's
but how do you know you're not lying to yourself, or that your teacher is actually not just talking from their own experience? How do you verify the actual validity of those statements that the teacher or that you're making about yourself?
Sure, I appreciate that. Did you want to respond to that?
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, and one of the skills, and again, it sounds dualistic, but one of the
that's okay.
That
I mean,
being taught, and a muscle that we're really trying to develop, is that of discernment. And that's kind of the million-dollar question, because anyone can get what they want to term guidance, and with a true open heart, earnest as heck, and yet that could actually just be the ego coming in the back door, and so the idea that we open ourselves to the inner teacher. That is just step one, and then you take a look at what it is that comes through, and you really practice this art of discernment, and that's actually what many of the lessons that Regina's teaching are centered around.
Okay, well, I understand what you're saying. Now, actually, that's the essence of Vedanta. We call it discrimination or discernment, and our definition of it, we have a very, very simple and clear definition of it. Our definition of discernment is knowing the difference between what's real and what isn't.
Right. Yes.
Now, in order to know the difference between what's real and what isn't real, we need to define. We need definitions. Our definition of what's real, which means the self or God or the truth or whatever the higher or whatever you want to call it, is what doesn't change.
Right.
What's eternal.
Right.
And ever present, and what is to be discerned? Anything that changes, that's not always present. So discrimination or discernment is on a moment-to-moment basis. knowing the difference between what's real and what isn't. Because if you know the difference between what's real and what isn't, you're not going to chase something that's unreal. But people chase unreal things because they think they're real. That's the problem. They think that, you know, falling in love and getting a good job and getting all these things, they think that's real. That's why they chase it. But our definition, all these worldly goals that people are pursuing, are by their very definition unreal.
Right.
Excuse me, we got some guy mowing the lawn out here.
I can't hear it at all. Do you hear it?
You can't hear it?
Oh, we can see him, but we can't hear him.
That's my wife. I think she's going to tell him to shut off the there we go.
Okay.
Anyway, it's distracting for me. He'll just have to wait.
Fair enough.
Anyway, so that's our definition of discernment, is knowing the difference between what's real and what isn't. And on a moment-to-moment basis, monitoring your mind, because you know, this ignorance of who we are always, you know, is operating all the time in the form of our fears and our desires. And we actually believe that what we want and what we don't want are actually real. And so the rubber meets the road when you come to, you know, your daily life. Because here this ignorant part of yourself, this needy, wanting part of yourself is saying, oh, you need that, or oh, you should avoid that, and right. So forth and so on. And you run off chasing these objects, or you get involved in all these sort of situations, karma, and so forth and so on. And you just build dependence on objects. And the whole idea of freedom is freedom, our definition is freedom from dependence on objects. Now, you know, so what is an object in Vedanta? An object is anything other than me, God, or me, the self. So anything other than awareness is an object. So, and that's a really strict definition. That includes your feelings and your thoughts and your body, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So our teaching is based upon, just to finish up this idea.
Sure.
Is scripture based? In other words, the teachings have all been laid out and been vetted over thousands of years. So we have a way of checking ourselves, and we have a way of checking our teachers, because the scripture stands above the teacher, and it stands above the student. It's something that's eternal, and that has enshrined this knowledge of God in a proven, practical, impersonal way. Because the whole idea with people is you can't trust them, and they don't even know that they're ignorant. They, you know, people think that ignorance is knowledge. That's the problem, huh?
Yeah, and we're running on what we've been taught, what we think we've learned. I mean,
yeah,
all of that's running in the background all the time. And if you're not aware of that, then there's little hope of
no, that's
go of
right.
That. Yeah.
Yeah, you're conditioning. I mean, you know, the whole, from the moment you pop out of the womb till right now, you know, you're the society and your parents and the media are conditioning you to think you're limited and inadequate and incomplete and insufficient and so forth and so on. So that program, you know, is running in everybody all the time. And how to separate that program from who you really are is a spiritual work that we do it, that you know, we do in Vedanta.
Yeah, I think, like you said before, I think we're absolutely on the same page. That's exactly what we're doing, what we're learning to do. Yes.
So separating the program from who we are.
That's correct.
Seems to just be exactly where we're sitting right now with our studies with Regina and gentle healing. And one of the kind of calibrating tools we're asked to go back to time and time again when we confront even the smallest things in our own life or the most subtle feelings in ourselves is to come back to our spiritual aspiration, come back to what we really want, and to use that and as kind of a proxy for sniffing out what's ego, what's the programming, and whereas deciding what it is that truly leads to freedom. It seems like that is definitely an art and a practice. And I just wonder if you could speak to the role of spiritual aspiration as we tease out this truth.
You see, for Vedanta to work, you need to be qualified. And we have a whole list of qualifications, one of which is we call burning desire for freedom, which is your spiritual aspiration. Right. In other words, your highest value is that you with freedom, love, truth, compassion, whatever it is. You have a value structure, and the highest value is always freedom and non-dual love. That's what we say, because freedom equals non-dual love. Right? In other words, if you're free, you're free of a sense of duality, and the wholeness and completeness of the God that you are, or the self that you are, is of the nature of love. It's called Parama Prema Swarupa. It's that non-dual unconditional love is the nature of the self. So what everybody wants is what? Is to love themselves and the world unconditionally, which is equal to freedom. So unless you have that desire, this is not going to work for you. In other words, the spiritual path is not going to work for you. And people come in all sorts of levels. Some people have piddling, some people have middling, and some people have burning desire to be free. Now, you know, the more intense your desire or your motivation to be free is, the quicker you're going to grow toward, you know, move toward your goal, or in your language, the faster you're going to heal.
Right.
Huh?
Exactly. Yeah. We could talk about willingness.
You get as much healing
as you're willing to undergo. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, most people, unless you've really suffered enough from the world, you're not going to have that burning desire. And that's what happened to me. I was rich and successful and young. Everybody's patting me on the back and telling me how wonderful I was, but I was like rotten to the core inside. I was suffering like a dog. And at that time, the Lord gave me this vision of non-duality. And from that point on, my desire to know the truth went off its charts. I quit drinking, I quit smoking, I sold my business, I quit making love with married women, I lost 50 pounds, And my life just went 100% in the other direction, and I never went back to the world from that time. So it was a very, very, was very lucky or fortunate by God's grace that I could realize this goal and set myself free so young. Because most people keep holding on to kind of, you know, in the back of their mind, they keep thinking, oh, maybe, you know, that's just around the corner, you know, that's wondering whatever is going to happen, you know, Mr. Right's going to come, or I'm going to win the lottery, or whatever it is. So they never develop that total commitment to freedom or the truth that is really required. And then the next one is this, we call discrimination, which we talked about. And the other quality is dispassion, which we define as indifference to the results of your actions. Now that's a big one, because the person who's doing actions is definitely not indifferent to the results. That's why he or she's doing actions. So what kind of person, you know, that's a dispassionate person who knows that the field of consciousness or existence, the world of action, is in charge of the results and not me. I can act, but I'm not in charge of the results. Now, if that's true, then whatever anxiety I have about results, I can offload immediately when I act. We call that karma yoga. Karma yoga means I understand that I can act, but I have no right to the result. In other words, that God or the field of action is going to deliver the results according to all the factors that are operating in the field, not according to my own personal desires. And understanding that was the quickest way to purify and remove that anxiety and those emotional problems that are associated with getting what I want and avoiding what I don't want.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then there are other qualifications too, secondary qualifications, you know, that we list too. There, we have a text called Crest Jewel of Discrimination, which is a standard text for explaining all of these qualifications, and they're quite they're defined very carefully and very logically and scientifically. And if you're qualified, then this Vedanta teaching works for you very nicely. And if you're not, then we have teachings that help you to qualify. We have what we call yogas or practices or therapies or however you want to call it, which will qualify you, and you will develop those qualities, and then you'll be able to understand that you're non-separate from God, or, you know, that you're free.
Right. Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. You know, that's the point. What's my highest value? You always have to question all the time. Is what I'm doing right now, you know, going to serve my highest value, or is it going against my highest value?
Yeah, exactly. What's it for?
And then that's what's it for. Then you need the strength to stand up to that voice in you that says, I want, I want, or the fear, I don't want. The fear and desire that's always there, you know, that is associated with all this stuff in the world.
So I can't imagine that there's a spiritual student out there that wouldn't love to have the gift of dispassion given to them. You know, because just the clarity that would come from that would be amazing. But and yet it seems to be something that as you just said, we can work towards developing more and more. The strength, even when you see it, to stand up and to actually take those steps. And I'm wondering if you could speak to how it is we can increase the desire, the burning desire for truth, and increase the strength to stand up, as you put it.
Well, you know, the thing is, you see, people are not analyzing their own experience. What develops, you know, that's what happened to me. And I see there's thousands of people that listen to me and come, and I have a number of, you know, quite a number of people that are quite close I teach. And I've discovered, and this was true for me, that it's just as, that what creates this dispassion is what? Is understanding the nature of the world, that every, you know, that the duality and every pleasure involves a pain, that it's a zero sum situation here, and when you see that the, you know, that every loss involves a gain, that every up involves a down, that every right involves a wrong, that there's no way you can actually beat the system here, that the system is the system is set up so you can't game it. And people don't seem to ever want to learn from their experience. And we do, see, Vedanta doesn't really work for people who aren't experienced enough, who haven't discovered this in life. So most of the people that come to this teaching are, you know, maybe 40s and 50s, some in their 30s, a few in their 20s. And we're finding more and more, particularly in Europe, more and more younger people who have come to this conclusion that you can't win here in this world of action, this world of desire and fear that's operating here. Yeah. And so that this passion develops automatically that way.
Well, and my experience has been that there are often a number of people on the spiritual path who have suffered some kind of foundational shaking tragedy, you know, a death of, yeah, of a loved one, or some kind of trauma will also bring people to this point.
Yeah, absolutely. Personal tragedy. Yeah. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, I'm doing a 3-month course on the Bhagavad Gita. The consciousness says that people come to me for 4 reasons. And the first one is because they're because of tragedy. In other words, from suffering. They're suffering too much, and therefore they come to the Lord. The second kind are people who are not suffering, but who want something. And they realize that there's always an unknown factor in getting whatever you want. And that unknown factor they call God. So they propitiate God to get what they want. They're like business people. But at least they're including God in the equation. And then the third class of people who are seeking the Lord are people who are not looking for anything outside. They're just curious about who am I, what I'm doing here, what the hell is this all about? They're not suffering. They don't have these traumas. They don't want anything in the world, but they say, Jesus, this is weird here. I've got this weird meat tube. I'm going to be here. I'm trying to make my way here. I'm going to die one day. What the hell is this all about? And the fourth class of people are very, very rare. They're the people who just understand directly and immediately that there's no separation between them and anything. So these are the 4 kind of devotees or people who are, you know, relating to God, the 4 different motivations for relating to God.
Right. And in that last category, that reminds me that I wanted to speak to you about this epiphany that you had as a young man in Hawaii. I don't know what your epiphany was, but I certainly had an epiphany, a real experience of a real understanding of. For me, it was like, oh, there's okay, everything's one. And of course, I wasn't thinking through this. I just had the experience. Everything's one, and then it just grew bigger and bigger and bigger until I had a real experience of what oneness was. That was many years ago. But it sounds to me like that sort of epiphany would put one in that fourth category. And I suspect that's what led
it will and it won't, because. Okay. Because many people have those epiphanies, but ignorance closes down. They think they're crazy, or they don't have any emotional support. I meet a lot of people who have been diagnosed as schizophrenics or having emotional problems, who are perfectly sane, but who made the mistake of telling the wrong people about their non-dual experiences and ended up with shrinks. And one fellow, young man, he's been an amazing guy. He had this amazing epiphany, and they locked him up for 17 years. And he was not. He finally sued the state, and he got a huge settlement out of it, because he wasn't. There was nothing wrong with him. And finally, and the government admitted they made a mistake, and they gave him a settlement. But that's the problem, is that this ignorance of who I am is so hardwired. When you see who God is, it just seems like an incredible. Such an incredible contrast to the nature of the world and to the suffering that we're doing here that, you think you've gone mad.
Right.
Like in my case, I've always been quite dispassionate and I just got it from my family. But in my case, I understood I just lost control of my body and mind totally, and I had this, like you say, this absolute experience of what reality was. And I knew that I knew that was far away. I didn't realize it was myself. I thought it was something that, an object that I had to attain. So I went on this spiritual journey and did all the meditations and did all this stuff, the drugs and all that sort of thing, to try to like recapture that state.
Right.
I didn't realize I was just experiencing my own nature. I thought it was just an experience. And the experience, it was an experience, but it was an experience that was reflecting the nature of myself. And I didn't realize that until I got to India and met this teacher. And then it became very clear with Vedanta, that I was just experiencing myself and that the covering was ignorance.
Right.
And that if I could remove that ignorance, and it was easy for me because Vedanta is scientific. It doesn't rely on a personal experience of anybody or of a teacher. It's because like I said, this is where the whole thing began. You're never not experiencing the truth of yourself. You're always experiencing it. It's just hidden by all these beliefs and opinions and all this conditioning. So
that's the work.
So that's the work. It's to peel away that conditioning,
right?
Once you understand what it is, it helps to have a clear vision of it. However, the problem with clear visions is the same thing that happened to me and happens to so many people. They keep thinking that the experience is what it is. And so any experience isn't going to last. So when the experience goes, they want to get the experience back. So then they do all these things to get the experience back. And they don't realize, no, I've got an ignorance problem here. I've got to erase these beliefs and opinions that keep me seeking experience and keep me thinking I'm this experiencing entity. So what Vedanta does, one of our definitions of freedom is freedom from the seeker,
right.
Freedom from the doer, this person that's doing and seeking and so forth. I need to be free of that person. And that's a hard one because we're born thinking we're doers. We're born thinking I walk, I talk, I sleep, I eat, all this, huh? that thought that I'm a doer is just so hardwired in everybody that you know, objectifying that thought is very difficult. And these Vedanta teachings definitely objectify the thought because they reveal the unexamined logic of your own experience. See, because this truth is operating deeply in us all the time. But because we're so extroverted and paying attention so much outside, we're not aware of how it works inside us. And Vedanta like peels away the surface and gives you a vision into the inner workings. And then you can see, oh, I understand. Because as I teach it, people say, oh, they're so surprised. But then they say, oh, I knew this all along. Mm-hmm. And I say, that's right. Of course you did. You know, all we're doing is taking away the cover. It's something you knew. And they feel very comfortable with the truth because they've actually known it. So it's a weird situation. They know it, but they don't know it.
Yeah, and we hide it from ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, you don't. That's not quite correct because you don't. You wouldn't consciously hide it from yourself.
Well, sure.
So this is where our idea of God comes in. God's the part of us that hides ourselves from us. Now that's a weird that's why we actually go beyond God, in the sense that God creates this amazing world, this illusory, ever-changing world, and because it's so fascinating and so attractive, and because we feel so empty and incomplete and inadequate and lonely, we chase it. Well, we think that these sexy objects that are presenting themselves to our in our lives are actually the solution to this feeling of loneliness and emptiness. So God's not doing this consciously, but because the world is not, the world is a benign projection. It's not an evil projection. So God's not trying to deceive us, but the fact that the world is so interesting and varied and new and exciting, and we feel so empty and incomplete, makes God like a deceiver, we call it. In other words, and we say, well, no, God's not deceiving you. Ignorance of God's deceiving you, because if you actually knew who God was, then you'd see this is a beautiful world. This is a pure reflection of God's glory and beauty, and you wouldn't try to extract value from it. You would just appreciate it for what it is. Whereas when you're feeling lonely and incomplete, you're just so needy that you're constantly grabbing for experiences to what? To fulfill that empty spiritual hole inside.
Anne here is writing notes furiously, so I suspect she has some more questions for you.
Sure.
No, I'm good. So the illusion that... the covering, the gauze that's hard to see through, I imagine is what is referred to as Maya.
Yeah, that's correct.
And what I've always struggled with is, what's the, and maybe this is, I'll just ask, the purpose of Maya is what? I mean, it's so helpful to see it as that and to experience it as that, but I would imagine that there's some method to this madness of Maya.
Well, yeah, it is. Maya has three aspects or three energies. Maya's called Maya Shakti. It's an energy. God's energy free. God's free of energy. But when you add Maya to God, then it becomes a world. It becomes a world of energy and matter. Matter and energy being non-separate. And those three energies there are three energies. One of them is a revealing energy. The other is a concealing energy. And the third is a projecting energy. So Maya has these three powers in it. And those powers are operating in everything, in everybody's mind, in every physical object and so on throughout the whole of creation. I've recently published a book called The Yoga of the Three Energies, which explains this very clearly, explains the whole science. But I'll just give you a little kind of a taste of it right now.
Thank you.
So when God creates the world, the concealing energy, it happens in stages, even though it's, we explain it in stages, even though it's a projection. So we explain it in stages so you get an understanding of how Maya works in your own mind. And so the first thing that happens is the world hides God from the individuals. God's always present as your own self. God's never apart from you. Now look at, if you look at my hand, what do you see? You'll say, well, I see a hand. That's what you say, right?
Right.
But what do you actually see? You're seeing two things here. You're seeing a hand and you're seeing light, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh? You can't see the hand unless there's light.
Yes.
But you don't say, I see light and a hand, do you?
Yeah.
Even though the hand is totally dependent on the light, if there's no light here, you're not going to see the hand.
Right?
Yes. And if I move the hand, the light doesn't move, does it?
No.
If I go like this, the light's still here, but you can't see the light. When you put the hand here, then the hand reflects the light. But when you say, when I say, what is this? You say a hand. Well, why is it that you don't include the light in that? That's what we mean by ignorance. Mm. You're experiencing it, but you don't know it. Because you don't investigate what's actually happening here. You just take the superficial appearance that your senses present to you as the nature of that object. That's what we mean by the concealing power of Maya. Huh? It's hidden in, the light is hidden in plain sight, we say. In fact, I'm working on chapter 9 of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called The Royal Secret. And the royal secret means this is a big secret because it's hidden in plain sight. It's so good you can leave the truth anywhere and everybody will walk by it because it's so obvious, it's so natural, it's so simple that because they're fascinated by the moving, changing, interesting shape or hand that or objects that are presenting themselves to the senses. So that's one power of Maya. When you don't know who you are, in other words, when you don't see yourself as a whole and complete spiritual entity, then you project your ignorance outside onto objects. And you think that what you think and feel is the truth about the object. We call that the projecting power. That's another power of Maya. A Byron Katie and all these people are trying, their whole thing is to help you to remove your projections. Are you familiar with Byron Katie
and
work and all that? You know where she says it's a nice little technique. I mean, it doesn't go far enough, and it obvious, but it's very helpful to people because you know when you point your finger at somebody, actually three of them are pointing back at you,
right? Yeah.
And you don't realize. So when you say, "Well, you're a jerk," then you have to ask, "Well, is that true?" And of course, your ego will say, "Of course, it's true," because
right.
You're because
yeah, I can tell you the story. I can prove it's true. Listen to this story, this one.
That's right. You're right, because that ego is under the spell of the projecting power. Mm-hmm. In other words, it doesn't want to say that it's the jerk. That the jerk is actually coming from me.
Right.
There's no actual jerk out there. But because jerkness is in me, I point. And I say, well, you're the jerk. So then in the third state, then she says, well, is that really true? Means what? You're questioning what your ego says about the nature of objects.
Right.
And then you turn it around and say, well, who would I be without that?
Exactly, yes.
Check, right? Well, you'd be happy without it, actually. but you don't think you would. You need that. What you need to conceal your ignorance from yourself by projecting it on others. So that's the second power of Maya. And then the third power of Maya is called Sattva, or the revealing power. There are moments when the mind is clear and the light of awareness shines on that mind and reveals the nature of objects as they are. This is where your epiphanies come in and where you're actually. Now, if your mind is clear and there's a jerk in front of you and you say that you're a jerk, then what? You're not projecting. Understand? If there's somebody in front of you, and it actually is a jerk, like Donald Trump, man, I don't know, man, you guys, maybe you voted for Donald.
No.
I don't know.
No.
But now, there's a guy, but which by common definition, generally, would be considered a jerk. You know, he cheats on his wife, he brags and all, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
All these weird values. So you say, well, he's a jerk. Now that wouldn't be a projection, because the object is that statement you made was true to an object. So when you're in a sattvic state of mind, when Maya's, in other words, when Maya's creating this clarity in your mind, huh? Then you see things as they are.
Yeah.
So
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that we practice a form of self-inquiry called root cause inquiry. And one of the things that we do in this inquiry is when we're looking at an upset, one of the questions we ask ourselves is, if my mind were perfectly healed, I would not be upset by this. So what is it that I'm believing about myself, yeah, vis-a-vis the world, all of that, that upsets me? Because I know that if I experienced myself pure, unaffected consciousness, I would not be upset by this. Yeah.
No, that's right. Now, that same teaching actually is there in Vedanta. It's called Mula Vidya. Avidya means ignorance, and Mula means root. So the root cause of all these projections is called Mula Vidya, or ignorance. Yes. Now, ignorance of what? Well, ignorance, as you say, of my whole and complete nature, of my full, ever-free, whole and complete nature. So the cause of everything is ignorance. And the only thing that's going to remove ignorance is knowledge. That's our point. Is that experience is not going to remove ignorance,
right,
because experience is generated by ignorance. In other words, I'm chasing all these things because I'm ignorant of my own nature, because I'm ignorant of the fact that I'm whole and complete and adequate and so forth and so on as I am. So that's a fundamental concept in, and that's called Maya. We call Maya Mula Vidya, because even that sattvic, even that clarity of your mind can be a form of ignorance. So you can get very attached to telling the truth and to kindness and beauty and all that sort of thing, and think you're actually God, when actually you're caught up in the spiritual myth.
Right.
Of who you are.
Yeah, we talk about spiritual ego, I think.
Spiritually. Yeah. We call it enlightenment sickness. I coined the term sickness. Enlightenment sickness. Yeah, you think you're enlightened when you're the light. How could you, if you're the light, how could you be enlightened?
Right.
Understand?
Right. So would you say that there is such a thing as enlightenment?
Well, you know, we don't like that word. We don't like that. Why? Because it implies that you were never, that it implies that you aren't the light and that you were never not the light,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yes.
It implies that enlightenment is an event. But we say that freedom or enlightenment, the light, is what? Is your nature.
Yes.
So that you're eternal. You're eternally aware. You're eternally conscious. You eternally exist. So you can't say that I got enlightened at a certain time. And if you do say that, then you're definitely going to get unenlightened, because anything you get, you're going to unget. And that's what you see in the spiritual world with all of these so-called gurus. You know, they get some kind of experience and they call it enlightenment, and they're all blissful and happy and brilliant and powerful and loving and all that sort of thing. And then after a while, what? That whole experience goes away. Huh? And they start behaving like the jerks that they really are.
Right. Yeah.
But they've convinced themselves and a whole lot of other people that they're enlightened. So they have to find reasons why they're behaving in such a way that's not in harmony with their true nature, which is awful. We call that the fallen yogis and so forth and so on.
It's
a shame. The spiritual world is absolutely full of those people. Who, because they've defined a particular epiphany as enlightenment. Now, you could use that word, and I used that word very provocatively in that first book. It's called How to Attain Enlightenment. That was all tongue-in-cheek. But I did that because I knew most people thought that enlightenment was something you could get.
Sure.
But I immediately debunked that idea. Once you get a little bit into the book, then you see that I'm taking the piss out of that idea. But you could say, well, from an individual's point of view, I am in the light, enlightened. In other words, I as an individual am always in the light of awareness or the light of God or the light of consciousness. And when I understand what my relationship as an individual is to the light, that, you know, then I can claim non-duality if I understand that there's no difference, for instance, between a wave in the ocean, mm-hmm. right? Or between the sun and the light. The sun and the moon are different, but they're not, are they? Because both are light. The sun is just the source of the light, and the moon is just a reflection of the light, but the essence of both is light. Even though one's generating the light and is the original source, and the second one's receiving the light, they're both, in essence, their identity is light. So the relationship between the total awareness or consciousness, the limitless consciousness, and the limited consciousness, or we call reflected consciousness, reflected consciousness means human beings, is what? Is awareness or consciousness. That's where the identity is between the individual and the total.
Sure.
You have a question?
Oh, go right ahead.
No. I'm turning to you
okay.
for a reason.
Yeah, so the dance of these three energies.
Be sure to get the book because it's a whole science.
Oh,
there's nobody's ever written this book. I've taken all that ancient Vedic wisdom and I made it available to Western people.
Fabulous. And the name of the book again?
The
Yoga of the Three Energies. You can get it on the website. We have both a paperback and a digital download. Anyway, as you were saying.
Yeah, I was just saying that this dance between the three energies, I've only ever heard Maya described in for lack of a better term, negative terms. You know, Maya's on you, Maya's coming. But this idea that the revealing energy, I mean, it makes sense. If that's the energy, then that would be...
Well, all three of those energies can be either good or bad. Because, in other words, in order to do your work, you need that rajasic, that project, you need energy, vitality.
Yes.
So to pursue your, you need, we call that rajoguna. That's the power of desire. And that's a positive force when that power of desire is motivated toward knowing God. That was your question earlier about will, and I call it burning desire.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
That burning desire, that desire is in you. It's just whether that desire is directed toward objects in the world which are going to, you know, tie you down, or whether it's directed toward knowledge of yourself, which is going to set you free. So the problem is that, you know, and if you're really ignorant, then you're just going to keep chasing objects in the world, and then desire is going to be a big issue. Whereas if you sublimate or convert that desire into a desire to know the truth, then that desire becomes a very positive force. So Maya's, you know, working with you and working against you. It just depends. The same with the third energy, which we call the concealing power. That shows up as dullness and stupidity and sloth and being really out of it and tired and sleepy and dull and indiscriminate. You know that energy that you feel in your mind, huh?
Yes.
That sleepy, dull energy, that keeps you from appreciating your nature. Whereas having said that, if you can't sleep well, you're not going to ever get anywhere in this world. So you need to, like, manage that guna, that we call that energy, so that, you know, you get your good 7 or 8 hours a day, but you just don't want that guna, that energy, operating during the day when you're supposed to be active and achieving things and so forth and so on. So, and the same with the sattva energy or the revealing energy. That's a huge help, but it can also be a detriment because you can develop vanity. You can think, I'm so cool, I'm so beautiful, I'm so wonderful, and you can claim all the qualities that belong to God actually are your qualities. which means you can get stuck in this enlightenment sickness thing. So each energy has an upside and a downside, because this apparent reality, this creation, is a duality. There, for every upside, there's a downside. For every downside, there's an upside. So, and those energies are all in this creation. I just need to understand what the value of each energy is, the upside and the downside, and then apply those scientifically to manage my mind. So our idea of healing the mind is managing your energies. That is, generating a preponderance of the revealing energy. Why?
Yes.
Because I can't, in when my mind is clear, then I can understand these teachings. If my mind is dull, it doesn't make sense. If my mind is projecting, I don't get it. Or I misunderstand what's being said. If it's dull, I don't get, I'm ignorant. If my mind is active, then I misunderstand. I project my own stuff on the teaching. I don't see it, hear it. Whereas if my mind is clear and still, then when I read the scripture or hear the teaching, it goes in as it's intended to go, and I can get direct knowledge that way. So we manage for a preponderance of sattva with supporting rajas and tamas. Tamas being basically for sleep and for practically grounding situations. So when I get a piece of knowledge, I want to make that practical. I want to get my life situated on a knowledge basis. I don't want my life situated on an emotional basis. My life infrastructure should be knowledge based, not emotion based or feeling based. And to do that, I need to get knowledge, and to get knowledge, I need that kind of quality, that clear state of mind.
Let me ask you about that for a minute, James. One of the things that we do is we do meditation in order to assist in having a clear mind so that we are open for that knowledge. Is meditation something that you do, something you practice?
Well, I don't practice meditation. I am meditation. My mind is always in a state of meditation.
Right.
But yes, yeah, absolutely. Now, because meditation generates what we call the revealing energy. That's the purpose of meditation.
Right, yes.
It makes your mind clear.
Yes.
Now, so meditation is a practice which develops this sattva and devotion for the truth. So, you know, these are important qualities. The problem is you can't really practice meditation unless you practice karma yoga. In fact, starting tomorrow, I'm going to teach the chapter on meditation. We're beaming this worldwide. We have a live streamed video going on for 3 months here, yeah. where I'm going through all 18 chapters of the Gita. And tomorrow, the chapter's on. We're starting the chapter on meditation. There, in meditation, you can't practice it unless you have karma yoga. And the reason is, karma yoga, why? What does karma yoga do? It reduces your emotionality. It's your therapy practice. And I explained what that was earlier. Because you can sit in meditation and you can get clarity, you can get peace, you can get a quiet mind, but as soon as you get up out of meditation and confront the world, here comes all your stuff back again.
Right.
And so then you think, well, how do I handle this? Oh, I've got to go back and meditate. And then you go back and meditate, and you have to work through all these issues, and then you get quiet and you're peaceful and you feel okay for a while. And then you get up for meditation, and as soon as the phone rings or somebody comes in and says something, off you go. Your mind gets disturbed again. So unless you got this karma yoga practice as a foundation, meditation's not going to work. But because the karma yoga practice actually removes your everything you do in daily life is removing these obstacles. It's not just leaving them sit or adding to them. Because in other words, karma yoga, every action becomes a spiritual practice. That's the idea. So my mind, if my meditation is backed by that practice, then what? I'm going to go deeper and deeper and deeper. My mind's going to get more and more and more clear. And that knowledge of who I am is going to be available in that state of meditation.
Yeah.
So karma yoga seems to be a real key to it. And I know.
Yeah, that's right. Karma yoga is the key.
Because it is reducing the emotionality that allows
that's correct.
Energy
that's
to come
right.
That
there
that
you go.
To come in.
Good language. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly the language we use. It's stress management. It's anger management. It's desire management.
I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
So that's what it does. Every object, every action that you do actually reduces your likes and dislikes. Huh? That's what, yeah? Because you're taking every action as a gift from God. So there's no bad actions for a karma yogi. There's no unfortunate events for karma yogis. The bad events are good events, and the good events are good events. So you're neutralizing your likes and your dislikes with this understanding. You offer your energy, your actions, into the field of existence, which is God, as a devotional service. You're saying, you've given me so much, Lord. Everything I have, you know, you've given me. Everything I value comes from you. I've actually created nothing here. I've been presented with this beautiful world and this beautiful body and this mind and these emotions and these life circumstances by your grace. And I'm happy to reciprocate this great gift by giving you my actions. You must have put me here for a reason. Therefore, I'm offering my actions to you. And whatever results that you want to give, I'm glad to take. I'm happy to take it. I take them as a gift from you. Now, what's that going to do? That ego, that part of you that just wants what it wants and wants what it doesn't, and, you know, tries to avoid what it doesn't want, that's going to be ameliorated by that practice. So the pressure, the subconscious pressure from your conditioning is going to be what? Slowly reduced. Now, that reduction, what, it just manifests as an increase in sattva, as an increase in peace and clarity and stability in your mind. And then meditation is simple. Then so your lifestyle, the attitude you take toward life and your lifestyle feeds into your meditation. Whereas most people who start meditation, they think, well, they just use it to manage their life. In other words, just to take the out to get the, yeah, that's right.
A little bit of balm.
It's just like a pacifier.
Yeah,
it's like a pacifier.
Yeah.
Then they go right back and they say, well, why am I so agitated? I got to go meditate. So they're just bouncing back and forth and they never grow. I've got many people who Buddhist people particularly or TMers and stuff who meditated for anywhere from 10 to 20, 25 years and it qualified them in a way. It gave them dispassion. But it didn't solve the problem. And when they heard this Vedanta teaching, then they said, oh, cool. And they kept meditating, but they meditated with the, you know, using the karma yoga and the jnana yoga, in other words, the knowledge to manage their minds. Because the next stage after karma yoga is, we call it jnana yoga or the yoga of knowledge. There, once your mind is clear enough, you can just apply these teachings to your mind directly when these thoughts and feelings come up. You don't have to indirectly remove them with karma yoga. So you can directly, they call that a direct path. You can directly use knowledge, but not until your mind is predominantly sattvic. So that's the idea.
And so Jacqueline had mentioned earlier that one of the techniques that we're taught to practice during an upset, when you're really having the upset and you're trying to get clear about it, is the root cause inquiry. But a step that we're being taught before that, before there's any clarity, when the upset is just raging, when you're just feeling the emotionality, is what Regina describes as rest, accept, and trust. And it's just as simple as it sounds, where you just rest your thoughts, you accept your feelings, and you trust that is your role right then. That is what you can do right then in your life.
Well, that is karma yoga. Yeah, that's karma yoga.
Yes.
That's karma yoga.
That's what it sounds like.
You accept your thoughts. You're right. I mean, it's whatever thought is there for a reason. And it's not, you don't put your thoughts there. You don't put your emotions there. Nobody's doing that.
Yeah.
Nobody's consciously thinking, oh, I'm feeling really good today. I think I'll be angry. I'm so tired of feeling good today. I think right now, I think I'll really get upset and frustrated. Does anybody think like that? Nobody thinks like that. Circumstances happen that produces emotions in you according to your conditioning, right? It's not your fault. So why would you take responsibility for it? Just relax, accept it, right? Trust it. It's right, huh? And take, we say just take it as a gift from God. That's what karma yoga is. Karma yoga has these two one is the right attitude, which I discussed, and the other is right actions. That doesn't mean I can go out and do a whole bunch of actions that are going to produce disturbances. In other words, bad actions, what we call adharmic or selfish actions, and expect to use karma yoga to solve my problem. I have to also have the right life, or I have to live the right kind of life, which involves living a simple life, a truthful life, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there are five basic rituals that are incumbent on karma yogis to make sure their lifestyle is in harmony. And so if your life and your life and your attitude are in harmony, then you're good to go. And you know, actually a very interesting thing that you mentioned here is, or that you suggested, is when people actually hear karma yoga, a lot of them lose interest in God as freedom, because their lives get so happy. We call it stuck in sattva. They get stuck in that happiness state, and they're satisfied there for a while. Then that basic root ignorance starts to operate in that happiness state, and then they want to go beyond. But the interesting thing about karma yoga is it really works. You know, make you to take care of your life in this world, and then you become dispassionate, and then self knowledge works for you. So the purpose of karma yoga is to turn an active person into a contemplative person. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, get that extroversion of the mind that's where the mind is just, you know, looking at your cell phone every 2 minutes to try, you know, trying to get information and figure out what's happening, what's going on, man. Oh my God, you know, you get that kind of mind out of the picture and have that mind turned inward, and where you can actually apply this teachings to you, you know, directly to your own mind, and remove your own ignorance. Because you need a teacher, but the teacher can't remove your ignorance. That's the interesting thing about, you know, a teacher can show you how to remove ignorance, and hopefully a teacher's removed their own ignorance. But it's totally up to you to get rid of your ignorance. But you need a technique, or you need a method, or you need knowledge or discrimination to be able to do that. So
I'm enjoying the questions that Anne is asking and the answers you're giving, so I'm happy to take a back seat. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I don't want you to back
seat. No, it's all good.
I want you right in the front. So you had just mentioned that there's actually five practices that a karmic yogi checks in with to make sure that they're staying aligned or staying on track.
Staying in balance. Yeah, we call them obligatory actions. And you want to know what those are, right?
I do. Yes.
the first one is to worship God, however you conceive of it. So that can be a personal deity or whatever. It can even be a sunset or some symbol of God. So daily devotional practice. To God, however you conceive of it, it's up to you. The second is worship of your parents, we call your parents or your ancestors. Now, why is that? That seems weird, but it's an extremely important practice. Why? Because most of our problems we got from our parents. Your parents are your primary ignorance givers. And obviously you don't think, you know, their parents don't think of themselves that way, and you don't know that they're dumping the ignorance on you, but they are. Your childhood is where most of this shit comes to you. And you blame most of this ignorance on your parents. Unless you had really good parents. I never had that problem because I got absolutely amazing parents. And I never had a bad feeling about them at all my whole life because they were just perfect. So I'm just so grateful to my parents. Even when I was a kid and having, fighting with them, I understood. But most people, have these issues, deeply buried childhood issues that they can't confront. And they've got it all tied to what my mom and pop did. And those, I've got to neutralize that, that projection and take that on myself and say, okay, I'm an adult now. These are my problems. I cannot blame those on my parents. They didn't know what they were doing. They didn't know they were dumping all this stuff on me. Their parents dumped it on them and it goes right back to the very beginning, to the primal beginningless root cause, the root ignorance. And so, I've got to take care about that issue by worshiping my parents, accepting them and loving them as they are and seeing, the good gifts that they give me, if there were any.
So it sounds like a gratitude practice. So to take that energy.
It's gratitude. In fact, karma yoga is an attitude of gratitude.
Okay.
That you want a little sound bite.
That's that transforming energy.
Yeah, it transforms that negative energy into a positive spiritual force. And then the third one is your teacher, the teaching and the teacher. You should have it. In Vedanta, you have, when you sign on, you get a teacher and you get a teaching. So you can't practice Vedanta without a teacher and a teaching. You need it. So you need to respect your teacher and understand the value of his teaching. And in other words, study the scripture every day and show respect for your teacher in some way or another, mentally and emotionally. The fourth one is worshiping people. That's a service. You're doing, like you guys are doing service work. This whole interview is a service to your community. So, because you love people, you want to give them what you know. So you're contributing to the world. So make a contribution to people. And the fifth one is environmentalism. It's looking after the environment, the air, the fire, the water, the space, all of the physical aspects of existence, the animals, the plants, and so forth and so on. So those are the five, and those are daily, those are incumbent upon each karma yogi daily. You can't just say, oh yeah, well I can't do that. No, every day you have, so it becomes a discipline. Karma yoga is a discipline, right? An attitude of gratitude that you express in these five areas of your life. And that sets a foundation. Because then the next stage is, we call it Jnana Yoga or Vedanta. And that has three phases. There's three stages in Vedanta. And that's listening, then reflecting, and then assimilating the teachings. Now, most people, the hardest part, one of the hardest parts, they're all difficult, but one of them, the hardest part is actually listening, actually hearing what is being said, and not projecting your own stuff or believing what you're hearing. We're not asking you to believe, except temporarily. Temporarily say, well, believe what the scripture is saying here, pending the result of your investigation. So
talk
about that?
Yeah.
So it's not blind faith. It's like you're going to be able to verify these teachings, but how are you going to verify them unless you actually hear what we're saying?
All right, hold them up, take a look. Right.
And actually, it's very simple, but all we're saying is you're beautiful. You're wonderful. There's nothing wrong with you. Your nature is love. You're really cool. You're so good. That's what we're saying. That all boils down to that. Why do we have to say that? I don't know. Well, because mom and pop and the federal government and the church and everybody else told us we were sinners and, we have all these problems and we actually feel that way about ourselves. So there's a big, there's a big gap between my vision of myself and the vision of the scripture, which is you're pure and perfect. And so I have to be able to listen carefully and have that discipline to put all my negative views about the world and myself on the shelf until I hear the teaching clearly. Once I've heard the teaching clearly, the next stage is reflecting on it, which means what? It means usually what I do, you know, what human beings do is they hear something and then they look and see whether what they hear fits with what they believe or think. And then if it doesn't fit, they throw what they hear away. But with Vedanta, it's just, that doesn't work. That we call that ignorance. No, well, you have to look at what you think and feel in light of what you heard and discard those bits of your understanding that aren't what don't conform with the truth so that your life starts to match up with the truth. That's hard to do because, you know, what I think is knowledge is often ignorance. No, yes, I may have a lot of knowledge. I may have right knowledge, but I don't know the difference between knowledge and ignorance. So that's what our discrimination is, this discernment you talk about, is knowing the difference between what knowledge is and what ignorance is, and discarding those bits of ignorance that don't serve my highest value. And then finally, and then at that knowledge...
Can I stop you just for a second, only because I'm afraid I won't remember my question? And I think you're more likely to remember the third step.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
I realize I'm getting distracted by hanging on to my question. We're in the midst right now of a stage of study where we're really embracing, opening to, seeking to embrace purification, and that in the language of what we're studying. I wonder if there's aspects of that to what you just said, and I'm just wondering if you could talk about the.
Both karma yoga, meditation, and jnana yoga, knowledge yoga, are purifying practices. They do purify. Those are purification. Because our view is you're not going to get free until your mind is pure, reasonably pure. That doesn't mean you got to be a saint. That just means you need to be sane.
Right.
Sane means pure, clear-minded, and solid and practical and present. So these are all, I'm just outlining what we call our sadhana or our purification practice, which is managing the gunas, karma yoga, and knowledge yoga and meditation. And devotional practice. Our bhakti yoga is what converting our emotions into devotion. It's a sublimation psychology that takes your emotions and converts those emotions into devotion.
That's sweet.
Yeah, because you know you're emotional because you're attached. Your feelings are associated with what happens, and what happens goes up and down. Sometimes it's favorable, and sometimes it's unfavorable. When it's favorable, you're all very emotionally happy. You know, as soon as the circumstances change, then you get emotional. Well, that's not right. You know, that's not correct. What kind of a person are you? If one, you know, this woman, one time she falls in love with me and she gets me to, gets a house next door for me to live in and we're supposed to start this big relationship. And then she meets a younger guy, you know, in a pub somewhere, a musician, handsome and all that sort of stuff, six pack abs and stuff. She comes like a week or two later to my door and says, I want you to leave. And I said, why? And she says, well, you know, I've taken up with this guy. I said, okay, I will leave, but just tell me one thing. I will leave, but you have to answer this question. And I said, are you the person that loved me yesterday, or are you the person that doesn't love me today? Because I'm really confused.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
And her mouth went... And she stood there for like 2 minutes. She couldn't say a thing, and she left. And like 2 weeks later, a big dump truck, a big moving van pulls up, and she and her new boyfriend ran off. And they moved out. You cannot be what is happening to you.
Yes, right.
Your emotions need to be stable. And those emotions, and there's one thing that will stabilize your emotions, and that's love of God. So all of our practices are love of God.
Right.
Knowledge of God is love of God. Karma yoga is love of God in the form of the field of my life. I love my life because this is God.
Yeah.
God's provided me with this life and so forth.
Yeah,
so
I really feel that devotion there when you speak about that.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just bringing you back to the, you had said three stages, and I had stopped you in the
second. Right, and by the way, we have 5 minutes left. I just want to make everybody aware of that.
God.
Hadn't this been fun?
It's been fun, yeah.
So you said that the three stages of Jnana Yoga, the first was listening, and that we all could would do well to take that to heart and recommit ourselves every day to some true deep listening. The second was reflecting, and that's the part where you're teasing out what's true, what's not true, letting go of the parts that aren't true.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then the third was assimilation of the teachings. And
okay, I didn't explain that clearly. Okay, now you're right. That's where I did stop there, and we didn't go on. When you've understood that you're free, that you're whole and complete, and that you're non-separate from God, you should be extremely satisfied with yourself in the world as it is. That's our definition of freedom. You're totally satisfied with your life and with the world around you.
Yes.
You have no criticisms anymore, because you see that the world is perfect because you're perfect. But having said that, sometimes there are deep issues that prevent you from enjoying the satisfaction of the knowledge. You know that you're okay, but what? But there are subjective psychological issues that you've been unable to root out during the listening phase and the reflecting phase. And so the third phase is what? Sticking with your spiritual practice until those subconscious issues have been removed and you are perfectly satisfied. So that's what we call assimilation. That knowledge needs to be assimilated. And their meditation is what? Simply applying the knowledge to your mind on a thought by thought basis. Whereas before, you're using meditation to purify your mind and get it still and so forth and so on. And to refine and develop your mind. In the final stage, you use your meditation simply to apply those teachings to your mind until you've rooted out these, we call them obstacles or samskaras that are preventing you from enjoying the fruit of the knowledge. Wow.
Perfect.
Anyway, it's all there in the book. And on the website.
Yes, and so let's tell the listeners again, your website is shiningworld.com.
Shiningworld.com.
Your new book is The Yoga of the Three Energies.
Oh, we got a lot of books. The latest, we're just publishing one on the yoga of relationships. It should be out in the next 2 or 3 days.
Wonderful.
There we're applying this to the whole topic of relationships.
Ooh, that's a big topic, yeah.
That's a big topic, yeah. My wife has written that. I've helped her edit it, and that'll be out, I think, probably within a week. The publisher's putting the finishing touches on it now. So we have a lot of books. The Yoga of Love is a really great book. The Yoga of the Three Energies. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can see there, we have a shop on the website where they're all there. A lot of those books are free. We have a section of Q&A. We call them satsangs or Q&A. There's like 10,000 pages.
Wow.
Of personal, back and forth between myself and my wife. She's a teacher of Vedanta also. Between us and people we teach, and on all these issues, on karma yoga, on Vedanta, on all these topics, there's thousands of pages. That we got a good search function, so you can just go in and search for the topic that you want, and they're practical everyday things that are really helpful that people have written in for years. So everything's on there. There's videos and book and the whole thing is there. So it's a big resource.
Wonderful.
And we're not saying you have to, we're just saying use it in conjunction with your practice, and because we're not against any spiritual practice or religion or anything of the sort. We just This Vedanta is just the knowledge that's behind all of the spiritual world, behind the physical world, behind the psychological world, and behind the spiritual world. So this is not in conflict with any particular religion or spiritual practice.
Wonderful. Yeah, and it certainly sounds consistent with what we've been learning. So we appreciate your perspective on it, and you're bringing that to us. Do you have anything you want to say?
Oh, I just want to thank you so much. I can't thank you. I can't thank you enough.
Okay, well, it's my pleasure. Take it easy, and good luck with everything.
Thank you so much, James.
Yeah, you bet.